I'm Peter Donat. At the conclusion of the previous program of Transformations of Myth Through Time, Joseph Campbell told the story of Tristan and Isolde, two lovers destroyed by love, a destruction born of the barren wasteland that was Christianized medieval Europe. The wasteland, a dead land of inauthentic lives and sterile hearts, a land suffering the life-desolating effects of the separation of nature and the human spirit. How is this land to be saved? And what, if anything, are we to learn from the story of its salvation? In this, the final program of the series, Joseph Campbell tells the story of Parsifal and the quest for the Holy Grail. It is the quest for the restoration of the spiritual life of Western man. To this, the greatest of medieval stories, Joseph Campbell attributes the highest inspiration of Western mythology.
When the story of Arthur went to France, as it did, the French were not interested in Arthur. He was the English king. They already had their native king, Charlemagne, with his stories. What they became interested in were the stories of Arthur's knights. Each knight represented a certain, might be called, spiritual inflection. Lancelot, the self-giving perfect lover. Tristan, the overtaken lover. Eric, the warrior who fell in love and lost his war prestige and then tries to recover it again. Galahad becomes the monkish knight. Percival, the heroic model knight, so forth and so on. And these wonderful stories all carry echoes from the old Celtic backgrounds from which they come. Every one of these knights has been traced back to a pre-Christian Celtic hero. Here we are in the realm of knightly combat, and it's in this atmosphere that the adventure takes place. Chrétien's Percival, Chrétien's Grail story. What's the source of the Grail story? Where does it come from? Chrétien says he got the story from a book that was given to him by the Count Philip of Flanders, who was a friend of Marie de Champagne, who was Chrétien's patron. We don't know where the book came from, but this is our earliest source for the Grail story. And then the Chrétien simply turned it into verse, into old French verse. Chrétien was a virtuosic versifier. One of the German scholars said he could shake couplets from his sleeve like a magician. It ripples along. He never finished it. Now, he was a cleric, and it may be that as he went along with the story, he felt he didn't like what it was leading to. The story was continued, as he left it, by what are called Chrétien's continuators. Some scholars see three men, some see five there. But they didn't continue the story. They brought in a lot of other Celtic material, dealing largely with Gawain and another set of adventures entirely. I spoke of then the quest of the Saint Graal, the two Cistercians who wrote the story from a monastic point of view. We don't know what their names were. First, the Cuesta del Saint Graal, and then after that, the Estuaire del Saint Graal. And they followed a man called Robert of Boron, who also had dealt with this story as dealing with the vessels of Christ's suffering. And here you have the ecclesiastical version of the Grail, in which the hero is Galahad. And the name Galahad, called Galahope, is supposed to have come from the Hebrew and means heap of witness. And it's definitely an ecclesiastical accent. One of the things you get in that story is the disqualification of most of the knights because of their secular character. And the only two that come through are Sir Bors and Sir Galahad. Poor Lancelot came very close to experiencing the Grail. He came to the castle, came to a room, and there was a priest celebrating the Mass who elevated the host. And an old priest, and he almost fell down because the host then became the body of the young Christ. It was more than he could hold. And Lancelot compassionately was moved to go into the room and rescue him, and he was struck down because he was unworthy to be present. Why? Because of his love for Guinevere. Now, to be healed of a sin, you have to have true contrition. He could not experience contrition for his love for Guinevere. That's beautiful. I mean, that a monk could get that one in speaks very well for him. The story, however, was developed to the full by Wolfram von Eschenbach, who was a Bavarian knight. And he understood knighthood and what it was about in a way that Gottfried never did, in a way that the monks couldn't. And here you have the hero Percival, Parsifal, as the ideal of the 12th century knight. I'm going to sit down if you don't mind to do this. Just because it gives an atmosphere of telling a story. The story is, Wolfram says, Chrétien didn't understand the story. I have, says he, as my source, the poet Quiot, K-Y-O-T. We don't know who that was. But Quiot is supposed to have been in Spain. And he is supposed to have gotten the story from a Moorish alchemist. So there are alchemical themes in this story. His version of the Grail is of a stone vessel, a stone that was brought down from heaven. Now, what he's doing there is imitating the Kaaba of the Muslims, the stone at Mecca, which was brought down from heaven. The Grail was a stone brought down from heaven by the neutral angels. There's the key. You know about the war in heaven, where Lucifer, the proudest of the angels, was asked to bow before man as God's highest creation. Formerly, God had said, bow only to me. Now he changes the rules and says, bow to man. And Lucifer would not bow. The Christian interpretation is that it was pride. He would not bow to man. The Shiite Muslim interpretation is that it was love for God. He couldn't bring himself to bow for anybody else. So that Satan in hell is God's truest worshiper. Now they say that the great pain of hell is not that of fire or whatever, but the loss forever of the sight of your beloved, which is God. And what supports Satan in hell? His memory of the voice of his beloved when his beloved said, "Be gone." This is the Shiite version. Well, one way or another, here was this war in heaven, and there were angels who sided with God, and there were angels who sided with Lucifer. A pair of opposites. You understand that the metaphysical mystery is to go past all opposites. Where you have opposites of good and evil, you're simply in the field of ethics. Adam and Eve were thrown out of the garden when they knew the difference between good and evil. Nature knows nothing of that. The neutral angels, neither on God's side nor on the devil's side. And Wolfram interprets the name of Percival as Perceval, the one piercing through the middle of the valley, going between the pair of opposites. So you see, this is heresy. We're in the realm of Gnostic traditions right away here. This is difficult stuff. Wolfram begins his whole romance with a long verse to the point that black and white are the qualities of every act. Every act has both good and evil. What are you going to do living? Since everything you do has two effects. He says, all we can do is lean toward the good. Now he goes back of Creighton and begins, I think I better stand up, I see you nothing, and begins with Parsifal's father. Parsifal's father's name was Gahmoret. Now you're going to hear something. Gahmoret was a Christian knight, but he was a knight adventurer, and he went to the Holy Lands, and he took service with the Caliph of Baghdad. Another thing Wolfram is saying to us is, virtue is not confined to the Christian world. These two traditions that are in conflict with each other. Gahmoret goes to Baghdad and becomes the knight of the Caliph. As the knight of the Caliph, he comes to a castle which is being besieged by two armies, a Muslim army and a Christian army. And he goes to the service of the queen of that castle. And she is known as the Black Queen of Zazamank. She's a Turkish queen. And she is an actual historical character. This period was the period of the Crusades. There were reports coming back to Europe of all kinds of Oriental adventures, Oriental temples, Oriental marvels. It was the period also of Islam conquering India. The Islamic conquest of India started 1001 AD and went on through to 1550 or something like that. So there were reports of the Islam was fighting on two fronts. They were fighting in India, they were fighting the European Christians. So these reports were coming in. And Wolfram places his scene in the world of the medieval battlefields. Not just a fairyland, as you have in many of the other Arthurian romances. This is right on the ground. And many of his characters have been identified. For instance, the name of the Black Queen of Zazamank is Belak. But if you translate that into an Oriental language, it's Belakana. And this means the wife of the widow of a warrior named Belak, who was killed in the Battle of Aleppo or something like this. I mean, there's actual historical characters. Gahmoret takes the service of the Black Queen of Zazamank and lifts the siege. So he's her hero, he becomes her knight, and he has married the Black Queen of Zazamank. She doesn't want her king, now the king of Zazamank, to go out and get killed. So she forbids him from going out and fighting. That's all he lives for, is fighting. So after having begotten a son on the Black Queen of Zazamank, he takes French leave and one night isn't there. He comes back to Britain, and there is this little unmarried queen named Herzoloide. And she decides to have a jousting festival, and the one who wins the jousting festival wins her. So the jousting festival takes place, and of course the one who wins is the king of Zazamat, namely Gahmuret, so he marries Herzoloida. He begets a son on her and goes out to fight some more, goes back to the Caliph of Baghdad and gets killed. So there are two widows, one in the Orient and one in Britain, of this great warrior. The Black Queen of Zazamat gives birth to a boy who is black and white. And his name then is Ferfiz, which means the feast, the sun of various colors, various hues, Ferfiz. He's a noble, beautiful youth. He's off there in the east. Herzoloid is sick and tired of courtly jousting, all that fighting. So she doesn't want her child, and she knows it's going to be a boy, I know. She doesn't want him to be in this thing. So she goes up to Marin County, you might say, and gets a little farm there, and won't have anything to do with what's going on in the court. And this boy, beautiful boy is born with the noble heart of his father, you might say, by nature, a knight. He doesn't know anything about knighthood. But he learns to make the javelins, and he sees a bird, and he spontaneously kills the bird, and then when he sees that he's killed the bird, he weeps, doesn't realize what his acts are going to do. And when he's about 15 years old, he's this blonde, callow bumpkin, is wandering through the field. A knight goes riding past with a girl, and boom! Suddenly three knights come along. They say, you see, a guy go past here with a dame. He goes down on his knees. He thinks they're angels. His mother's talked to him not about knights, but about God and angels and all those things. So the only other thing he knows about are angels. And he goes down on his knees, and I say, get off your knees. You don't kneel to knights. That's for angels. Knights? What are knights? Well, we're knights. How does one become a knight? You go to Arthur's court. Where's Arthur's court? Down the line. So he comes back to his mother and he says, I want to be a knight. She faints. Well, she says to herself, I'll fix him. So she makes him a costume of hemp, some coarse cloth, in a form that is for fools, kind of heavy one-piece thing coming down to about mid calf of his leg, and he looks a simple fool in these things, but what a boy there. And he gets on the farm horse. He's got his javelins in his quiver on his shoulder. He goes jogging off. She trots after him. When he turns the corner, she drops dead. So that's not the good way to begin your life, by killing your mother. But again, he didn't know he did it. Just as he's arriving in Arthur's court, a knight in flaming red armor is coming out carrying a golden chalice. Now, this is a king, one of the greatest kings in the world, who feels that King Arthur has stolen some of his property. So he goes in to challenge King Arthur. And he does it by riding into the court, going right to the table where Arthur and his knights are sitting, and Guinevere by Arthur's side. And he takes the wine glass from Guinevere and throws the wine in her face and says, anyone who wants to avenge this, meet me out in the yard. Just at that time, this lout rides in and thinks, oh, I'm going to be the champion. And he rides out to kill the king. Well, when the king sees this phenomenon on a farm horse, you know, in a fool's rig coming at him, he won't even insult his lance by using it properly, but he turns it around the other way and just slugs him off the horse. Parsifal and his horse are on the ground. Parsifal reaches, takes a javelin, and sends it through the knight's visor into his eye and kills the knight. That's not the proper way to kill a knight, so Arthur's court is now twice shamed. Arthur, meanwhile, has sort of caught on, something's on here, my God, what's happening? And he sends a young page out to see what's going on in the yard. The young page finds Parsifal dragging the red knight around to get the armor off, doesn't know how to do it, So the page helps him get it off, puts it on him. Parsifal gets on the knight's big horse. He knows how to start the horse, but not how to stop it. And boom, he's off. This is Parsifal off on his career. The horse goes full tilt for the rest of the day, and at evening pulls up at a little rural castle by Santa Rosa, somewhere up there. And this is the castle of an old knight who has lost three sons in jousting, and he has a little lonely daughter there. So the Red Knight pulls up. As far as they know, this is the Red Knight, the great king. Oh, come in. They take the armor off, and here's this fool underneath. What a shock. But old Gurnemont, the old knight, he knows how to judge male flesh, and he sees this is some boy. Also, he thinks, somebody for my little daughter. So he teaches him the arts of knighthood, how to handle weapons, and what the honor system is. And among the requirements of the honor system is a knight does not ask unnecessary questions. Important. If you want to be a proper knight, you don't ask unnecessary questions. It's a lovely, lovely, idyllic period in the romance. And finally, the old man offers his daughter to Parsifal. Now that's good old standard stuff. I told you earlier, the problem was the wasteland. People living life inauthentically. Not their life, but the life that's put on them by the society. And Parsifal thinks, I do not marry a woman who is given to me. I earn my wife. That's the beginning of marriage and love united. This is the first reply to the split between love and marriage. He has a lovely scene where he takes his departure of the old man and rides off. And now next, he lets the reins lie slack on the horse's neck. In this tradition, the horse represents the will in nature, and the rider represents the rational control. Here, nature is what's moving us. Now, when you realize that in the Christian tradition from the Near East, nature was fallen. Nature is good and evil, but we've got to be good. This is a tradition that does not say yield to nature. It says correct nature. And Wolfram is here saying yield. And the nature of that horse carries him to a castle. Now, this is the castle of a young orphan queen who is exactly his age. And her name is Conduire Amour. Conduire Amour, the guide of love. The castle is in distress. He comes in, and when they take the armor off, you know, the first thing always was to take the armor off a knight. And he was all covered with rust, because this stuff got rusty inside, and then give him a nice bath and something soft. So he was received and bathed and given soft garments and so forth. Then came time to go to bed, and he is given a bed in which to sleep the night. He wakes up in the middle of the night, there's somebody kneeling at his bedside weeping. It's the little queen. And he says, oh, remember what mother said, you don't kneel to anyone but God. If you want this bed, I can sleep over there. Well, she said, if you'll promise not to wrestle with me, I'll get in and tell you my story. And De Wolfram says, but she was dressed for war. She was wearing a transparent nightgown. So she gets into the bed, and she says, let me tell you how it is. Here's this king. He has sent his knights to take my castle. Good old medieval stuff. He wants to unite my land with his land and marry me to confirm the appropriation. He says, rather than marry him, I would jump from my tower into my moat. You've seen my tower, how high it is. You've seen the moat, how deep it is. Well, says Parsifal, who's running the army out there? And she tells him the name of this great knight. He says, well, I'll kill him in the morning. She said, that's fine. So he goes to sleep. Now he's wearing this red armor. Nobody knows who he is. In the morning, down goes the drawbridge. The red knight comes pounding down. And by gosh, within a few half hours or so, he's got the leader of the invading power on the ground. He's ripped off his helmet, about to cut his head off, and the knight says, I yield. I'm your man. Well, he's learned all the lessons. He says, you go to Arthur's court, tell them Parsifal sent you. Well, during the course of the next few months, a number of people arrive in Arthur's court saying, this red knight sent me. And Arthur says, boy, we really lost something there. So the court starts out to find him. That's another part of the story. When Parsifal comes back, Conduero Moors has put her hair up in the way of a married woman. They're married. This is marriage from love, the mind's love, the love of character, the love of quality. And they go to bed. Well, he doesn't know anything. She doesn't know much more. And so they just lie there. As Wolfram says, not many a lady nowadays would have been satisfied with such a night. And then there was the second night, and there was the third night. And then Parsifal goes, oh yes, mother told me. And so Wolfram says, if you'll pardon me for letting you know, they interlaced arms and legs and thought this is what we should have been doing all the time, and the marriage was consummated. No priest. The answer, marriage is the confirmation of love, and love, or sexual love, is the sacramentalization of the marriage. That's bringing the two terms together. The first time it's been done, and this is the ideal of marriage actually in our world today. Marriage for love. For most, this is the most difficult kind of marriage. Because the whole basis of it is relationship, a person to person, not to this function, that function, or another. And the level, now the point here is, it was not marriage that began with physical sex, it ends with physical sex. That's the other part of it. It starts in the spirit, and it's fulfilled in the flesh. This is Wolfram. I mean, he tells us this. Well, they have a little boy, and she is pregnant again. And Parsifal thinks, I wonder about mother. Well, mother's dead, but he doesn't know it. By now, we're 2 years on. He is one of the great knights. He has achieved fulfillment in the world then as it was. And he is ready for the spiritual adventure. No monk knight, no Galahad. The spirit is the fulfillment of life, not something instead of it. He asks her permission to ride back and see how his mother is. And his queen gives him permission. So he rides off. Again, the reins are slack on the neck of the horse. And that evening, he pulls up at a lake. And out in the lake is a boat with two men in it fishing. And one of them has on his bonnet peacock feathers. This is the Grail King.